episode of The Damage Report. I'm John Iadarola. It is going to be a big show. I always say that. Contractually obligated, in this case, it happens to be mostly true. Partially because we have three awesome guests who are going to be joining us throughout this show. We've got Dave Leventhal joining us once again to break down the current situation with the FEC, which is a bigger mess than you perhaps know at this point. Jason Stanley, an author, literally wrote the manual on how fascism works. He's going to be joining us once again to break down where we're at as a country right now, and how we can expect the proto-fascists to respond to some of the political pressures that this person is. I'm not gonna say who it is. You just look at the political context, you see if you can figure out who it is. We also have Ryan Grimm is gonna be joining us to break down some of the news of the day, including Tucker Carlson launching a new attack at Bernie Sanders because of his health difficulties. We're gonna be talking about that. Also closing out the show with Meanwhile In. We've got news from a couple different countries around the world. Also news from outside of this world, outside of this solar system. What is lurking outside our solar system? It's actually pretty fascinating. So we're gonna break that down for you a little bit later on. Before we get to all of that, we've got this massive mess of breaking news from yesterday and earlier this morning to get through. So we're gonna start off with Ukraine. Donald Trump, one of his strategies from the pressure that he's facing, this impeachment inquiry, is to attack the credibility of the whistleblower. He's been doing it, his defenders have been doing it, saying how dare this whistleblower, this unaccountable whistleblower, imply that the president is trying to get foreign countries to investigate Joe Biden and his family. That argument is a little bit harder to make this morning, considering what Donald Trump said during Chopper Talk.
Well, I would think that if they were honest about it, they'd start a major investigation into the Bidens. It's a very simple answer. They should investigate the Bidens, because how does a company that's newly formed, and all these companies, if you look at, and by the way, likewise, China should start an investigation into the Bidens, because what happened in China is just about as bad as what happened with Ukraine. So I would say that President Zelensky, if it were me, I would recommend that they start an investigation into the Bidens.
So that video from this morning, that was just, you know, Trump being Trump. If we had found out, let's say we weren't where we're at, none of the Ukraine stuff had happened. There was no whistleblower, there was no transcript or memo or whatever. We didn't have any of this. And we found out that on a call to the political leadership of China, he had mentioned investigating Biden. That would have been a scandal. He just did that on the lawn of the White House. God, what a weird world we live in. I saw something that was fascinating, and it was captioned, "Life comes at you fast sometimes." And it was NBC News. It was a shot of their website. The article was Kevin McCarthy tells Pelosi to ditch impeachment inquiry because this whole thing is made up. He's not actually trying to pressure anybody. And at the top of the page was a breaking news bar of Trump tells China to investigate Biden. He just did it again. That response, by the way, was in response to what do you want Zelensky to do? So what do you want the president of Ukraine to do? He said, investigate Biden. Oh, and also China, investigate Biden. But what's perhaps even more fascinating and potentially damning for him is what happened right before that question. So in like a 1 minute period, he talked about China twice. You just saw the second time he talked about China, that China should launch an investigation of Joe Biden. Let's take a look at the first though and compare the two. This was tweeted out by Ryan Strzok. Trump at 10:37, 24 a.m. talking about trade negotiations says, quote, "I have a lot of options on China, but if they don't do what we want, we have tremendous power." 30 seconds later, likewise, China should start an investigation into the Bidens. Is that as damning as I want you to do me a favor though? Perhaps not, but that's really close, butted up against each other. Like, I don't even know if you could fit the words quid pro quo between those two sentences where he's like, if China doesn't do what we want, we have tremendous power over them. China should investigate the Bidens. Again, like I keep saying, this is not a complicated story. It's an absurd story. It's surreal in many ways, Lovecraftian in some ways, but it's not a complicated story regardless of what Ainsley Earhart might tell you. He is putting pressure, economic pressure, military, you know, funding and equipment pressure on foreign powers to investigate his political opponents. That's all it is. And that is obviously illegal, but also goes against everything that our country is supposed to stand for. And as I've been saying over and over, we have to make a decision as a country, as each individual. Do we want to live in a country where the president is bound by the law? Or do we believe that power is power, and if you have the White House, you can do whatever you want? Hey, he's my guy, I don't care what he does. A large percentage of the American public does actually believe that. A smaller percentage is ready to overthrow American democracy in defense of that president. That's what we talked about yesterday on the show. But the rest of us need to decide, where do we draw the line? Do we want a presidency that is bound by laws, or do we want just a king that, you know, we hope that norms keep him in line? And if not, we had a good run. Democracy was interesting while we had it. That's the choice that faces us right now. And what you just saw, that ridiculous stuff, I mean, it begs the question, why is he so open about these things that he already knows have launched an impeachment inquiry? There are a lot of potential explanations. One is that he is literally the dumbest person in the country. If that is what you believe, there's a lot of evidence to buttress that position. There are other explanations too. I know Cenk Uygur was tweeting this morning that he really does appear to not have any fundamental idea of what is moral or immoral, legal or illegal. I don't know which of those is worse, if he's like ignorant of the law or doesn't care about what the law is. But regardless of which the explanation is, we can see what he's doing. Whatever he is believed to have done in regards to Ukraine, which you can literally read the transcript of, he's just doubled it by adding a far larger, more powerful country that he has been engaged in for a couple of years with really tense trade negotiations, strikebacks, tariffs, all of that. This is not a situation where you can say, well, yes, he's asking them to investigate Biden, but he's never shown a willingness to do harm to them if he doesn't get his way. That is virtually all he's done in regard to China in his time as president. And so it's hard to imagine that he would not put pressure on them to do more in this particular area. By the way, I love the juxtaposition between today and yesterday. Today, he goes on Chopper Talk, national TV, and says, I want Ukraine to investigate Biden. I want China to investigate Biden. Just yesterday, we showed you a poll result that shows that despite everything that we know, everything that we've seen, only 40% of Republicans, not that quite yet. That's embarrassing, and we'll get to it. Only 40% of Republicans think that he brought up Biden on that call, even though it's in the transcript. He's doing it on TV. He's shouting it at you. That's going to be on Fox News, Shep Smith at the very least, if nothing else. And yet, they just don't see it. In the video, by the way, one of the quotes he said in that video he showed you was, if it were me, I would investigate Biden. But like, dude, don't talk about it as if you're not involved in the situation. You've already told Zelensky that that's what you want to do. You tried to make it you involved in this thing. And we don't have time to go through all of the ridiculous developments over the past day, the Adam Schiff weird conspiracy theories, not going to bring up Nickelback beyond this statement right here, because we shouldn't have to on a political news show in 2019. I will only say this, if you're a Trump defender, man, you really picked the wrong horse to back. Like, the whole thing they've been saying is, you're exaggerating, he's not trying to get them to be investigated. And he just threw all of them. He took Giuliani and stacked Hannity on there and Mark Levin and all of them, and he just took them all and he just threw them all under a big bus. And they're gonna have to go back, like, take a couple hours, regroup and figure out what the new defense is, and hope to get it out there before he sets that on fire too. Does he think this is a good strategy? I will leave you with this. He tweeted out again a Breitbart News poll, this time about Adam Schiff. That's their new target. This weird conspiracy theory involving Adam Schiff shows that 98.4% believe that he should resign and be investigated. It is an online poll conducted by Breitbart. And he tweets it out because he thinks that it means something, or at the very least, he knows that his followers will think that it means something. And they will do that because they believe that belief is based on what you want to believe, not based on the evidence. And they've been trained over the past few years to believe crazy things about polling. And that's where we're at as a country. But you saw it right there. He just came out and admitted it. And we'll see what the Democrats do with it. Okay, we're gonna take a short break. We come back. Dave Leventhal joins us to break down the mess that is the FEC after this.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity. The UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it, "You must unlearn what you have learned." And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
About huge influxes of money into our elections, including the election we're in right now, and you're worried that some candidate might cheat the system, then what you want, what you need, is a strong FEC to look into potential rule breaking. And thankfully, today actually, they have a meeting scheduled. Unfortunately, they won't be able to actually have that meeting because they literally don't have enough members to have a quorum to hold official business. It seems crazy. It gets even crazier. And so we're joined by the man who broke this story, senior political reporter for the Center for Public Integrity, Dave Leventhal. Welcome back to the show.
Hey, John. Good to be with you.
Good to have you here. So I have it right, right? They literally cannot meet in the way that they're supposed to right now.
Well, not only can they not meet, but the Federal Election Commission, which was set up in the aftermath of Watergate to enforce and regulate campaign finance laws in the country, can't enforce campaign finance laws. They need at least four commissioners in order to do pretty much all of their higher functions, meet in public session, enforce the law, penalize scoff laws, make formal investigations of political committees or politicians who might be doing something wrong. They can't do any of that right now because they only have three commissioners who are serving on the FEC as we speak. So until they get back to that magic number of four, the FEC more or less is dead in the water, and they can't do any of the things that we just mentioned.
So whose fault is this? Who's stopping more people from being put onto the FEC so that they can actually make that quorum?
Sure. So here we are on day 33 of this kind of semi-shutdown, and it really takes a two to tango here. Number one, the president of the United States, of course, in this case, Donald Trump, must nominate FEC nominees to the commission. And that's a job of the U.S. Senate to go and have a hearing and ultimately approve those nominations. So we got two things going on here. Number one, we've got the president who's only nominated one FEC commissioner who's been languishing for about 2 years to the FEC. Mind you, there are three right now vacant spots. And then the Senate hasn't taken up that one nominee and is kind of in sort of a minor fight or spat with the president over what to do with the whole commission. Mind you, John, all six commissioner slots are either vacant right now or are being occupied by people, commissioners, who have well overserved their six-year terms. Federal Election Commission commissioners are only supposed to be there for 6 years, but collectively, the three who are remaining have served 29 years past the expiration of their respective terms. So it's kind of a mess over there, to say the least, and the Senate and the president just haven't been able to get together on the question of whether to just push through one nominee and get the FEC back in functioning, or to kind of clean the whole slate and get six new commissioners in there, which they could do at this point, even as odd as that sounds.
Well, the last thing we need is a body filled with people who have stayed well past their expiration date. We've already got the Senate and the House of Representatives for that. So he should have nominated more people. The Senate should have taken it up. Presumably, the Democrats, I'm assuming, can try to throw up some roadblocks, but the Republicans control the White House, they control the Senate. So is this just on them to do their job? And if so, why are they not doing it?
So I spoke to the White House a couple of weeks ago and asked that very question, said, well, what do you want? And what they said at the White House, President Trump's spokesperson said, well, the Senate should go ahead and move forward with the one nominee, a guy by the name of Trey Traynor, an attorney from Texas, a Republican. And the White House wants the Senate to go ahead and pass him through the system, which they have not done yet. That would get the FEC back up and functioning, at least at a basic level. But Senate Republicans, who I've talked to, have a different take. They want to see all six commissioner slots filled with new people who are going to both take care of the vacancies at the FEC right now, and also to get rid of the three commissioners, a Democrat, a Republican, and an independent, who are there and who have overserved their terms by many, many years. Senate Democrats, meanwhile, have actually put forward to President Trump a commissioner suggestion, somebody who Donald Trump could nominate, because the FEC is a bipartisan organization, a bipartisan independent agency. So Donald Trump has to nominate no more than three people from any one party to the FEC. So right now, Donald Trump hasn't taken the Democrats up on their offer. This is a person who right now is a lawyer at the FEC. Her name is Shauna Broussard. She would be the first African-American ever nominated to the FEC if ultimately she gets nominated. And it's unclear as to what the White House is going to do with the Democrats' recommendation for Shauna Broussard.
Yeah, so some of these arguments as to why we can't move forward on this sound, I don't really buy them necessarily. Like, okay, you want all six to be filled. Filling one of them, that gets you 1/6 of the way there. And then you just have to do five more. And what concerns me is that if this is the watchdog, if these are the cops in this area, then having it not be stocked, having it so that they can't actually do a quorum, that isn't just a neutral thing. That benefits one group of people, people who violate campaign finance laws. And in a time where on one side, I mean, some of the Democrats have raised a ton of money. Trump and the Republican Party have raised something like $125, $135 million in the last quarter. This doesn't seem to me like a good situation for there to be nobody looking over people's shoulders. Am I too concerned? Am I exaggerating the threat here?
A lot of folks would agree with you. Now, the FEC doesn't have the FEC police. They're not a criminal law enforcement agency.
Yeah, I'm speaking metaphorically, of course.
And by virtue of that, they are going to be able to be limited in what they could do. But bottom line is they are the tip of the spear when it comes to investigations for any type of wrongdoing that could happen in our campaigns as it pertains to money. So if you're not investigating people who are working on the margins, who might be doing the wrong thing, who might be breaking a law, then it's a situation where, yeah, the bad actors out there are going to kind of get a pass or potentially get a pass. Now, the Department of Justice and criminal matters can get involved in campaign finance matters. That is their purview. But by and large, the bulk of the work that gets done when it comes to investigating campaign finance matters, John, happens at the FEC. If you have no FEC, they can't do that work. And we could have a situation here that lasts weeks or even months without the FEC playing that cop on the beat role at a time when quite literally hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars are being raised in the 2020 election right here and now.
Yeah, I mean, that all sounds scary. Thankfully, the one thing we have going for us is that I can't really think of anyone who would try to use this opportunity to influence an election in a legal way. So we do have that going for us, Dave. As always, thank you so much for joining us. And considering some of the high profile stories that the media, I think rightfully, is focusing on a lot, you keeping an eye on groups like the FEC, more needed than ever before. So thank you for the work that you do.
Oh, I appreciate that. Thank you, Joe.
We're gonna take a short break here. When we come back, Jason Stanley, author of How Fascism Works, gonna join us. Seems like a good time to understand the process after this. If you were concerned about the potential rise of fascism in America outside of a potentially moral threat to the Trump presidency, now that there is an impeachment inquiry on, it seems like potentially an even more relevant topic to study up on. And so I went to the man who literally wrote the book on the process. And we're joined now by Jason Stanley, Jacob Orowski, professor of philosophy at Yale University and author of How Fascism Works, The Politics of Us and Them. Jason, welcome back to the show.
Thanks so much, John. Good to be back on.
It's good to have you on. So I've been thinking a lot about this as this inquiry has gotten on, and I've been listening to the defense of the president. I've listened to what he's said. And so I'm going to have some questions about that in particular. But for people who haven't done much studying about fascism, like I said, you literally wrote the book. What is one or two important things for people to understand that they might not already be thinking about?
So fascism is ultimately based around the concept of loyalty. It's one leader who claims to represent his people, which are the disaffected, the disenfranchised, the forgotten man, if you will. Mm-hmm. And it's based around race or ethnicity or religion. The idea is the true people come from a very particular national tradition that was once great and has been disgraced. And they need a strong leader to come and take the reins and return the nation to its greatness, to its military greatness. They need to protect it from the liberals, the elites, the socialists who are ruining it. And there's always an enemy, a minority, immigrants. The British, the motto of the British fascist movement was Britain for the British. Oswald Mosley called for a complete ban on immigration. Mm-hmm. You want to return the country to its pure past. And it's based around loyalty, loyalty to an ethnicity, loyalty to a religion, and loyalty to a leader.
Well, we are certainly seeing a great deal of loyalty to a leader in the last week or two. So what I'm curious about then is if this is based around a strong loyalty to this person who personifies taking the country back to a generally mythical idea of what it was once like. What about when there's a threat to that individual, to that leader, potentially to that movement? If Trump was to be shunted out of the White House, that would be a big step back for the Make America Great Again crowd. So how would you expect a lawyer and a movement, or sorry, a leader and a movement to respond to that sort of threat?
Harshly and with desperation, with excluding anyone who's competent and replacing them by loyalists and family members. If you look back at Hannah Arendt's Origins of Totalitarianism, she again and again makes the connection between the fascist leader and a mob boss. You find this in much of the literature in fascism, the connection between the mafia, the mob, because that's based on loyalty. So Arendt talks about how competent people who want to run their institutions according to the rule of law get jettisoned and replaced with incompetent loyalists again and again, and the process keeps strengthening. And it's like watching a movie. It's like there's constant drama about who's in and who's out. Mm-hmm. And it's friends and loyalists replace all competent people, because competence is a danger to the leader.
I think that Rudy Giuliani would make an amazing case study for what you just described there. So I have heard Trump has referred to this not as an impeachment, but as a coup. He probably picked that up from Fox News because they've been saying it around the clock for more than a week now. And he's tweeted out a quote from a supporter about a potential civil war. We've heard a lot about this sort of civil war talk. So is this rhetoric that is just used to get his supporters to defend him? Or based on your study of other examples of countries falling to fascism, is this something that we should be genuinely concerned about?
It's something we should be genuinely concerned about. Just historically, it's always the case that the supporters say it's just rhetoric. Victor Klemperer in The Language of the Third Reich has this discussion with a friend of his who turns into a Hitler supporter. And the friend says, it's just rhetoric. It's just rousing people. Now, one thing you find in the dangerous speech literature, for instance, Susan Banesh's Dangerous Speech Project, is they say, look, a free press is the weapon against this. When you have alternative voices, alternative presses, then you have a weapon whereby people can look to different voices. But what we have now is we have people siloed. People are not paying attention to alternative voices. And the president's supporters only pay attention to Fox News, and they only pay attention to the president. So I'm deeply concerned that we're going to get a situation that reflects countries where there is no more free press, because it's not like the president's supporters pay attention to other press other than essentially what is now the White House's state media, Fox News.
Well, I think that I have a great example of that that we discussed on the show yesterday. It was a polling result that showed that only 40% of Republicans believe that Donald Trump brought up Joe Biden in his call with the Ukrainian president, even though it's in the transcript that was released by the White House. And so I noticed a quote from your book. You had tweeted this out saying, "Facts are debased, and without a common understanding of reality, reasoned debate becomes impossible." And so I'm concerned about how we can have a serious conversation about whether Donald Trump should be removed from office or not when one side seems to have no interest in what's actually real. Is that a legitimate concern too?
Oh, it's beyond legitimate. The president has been hammering on this since before he came into office. It is a classic fascist technique. I think if you ask his supporters, they would maybe deny that they were, what they would say is that everyone's doing it. Because what the president has done and what the Republican Party has been doing is they've been acting as if the assault on truth is ubiquitous, as if truth itself doesn't exist. There are only sides. There's only your side and my side. And Trump, like a classic mob boss, is just saying loyalty to me is all that matters. The facts of your enemy are the enemies of your facts. And so that's the situation we're in. I think you'd find many Trump supporters saying, sure, maybe he did do this, but he's just doing it because the other side does it too. So that's the goal. The goal is to say that everyone's lying. And so at least I'm lying and I'm your leader.
So you have this great sort of general principle or rule about how fascism works on misinformation. I've seen you've summarized some sections on victimhood from your book. Are there any other general principles from your study or historical analysis that you think would be useful going forward in trying to figure out how his supporters are going to react or talk about the situation, how Fox News is going to organize the defense of the president?
Well, what's essential to remember is that this president is not on the side of his supporters. This president passed a $1.5 trillion tax cut for the wealthiest Americans. It's classic fascism to flip everything to the other side. So corruption, he's always accusing others of what he is most guilty of. So we're gonna see that continue. We're gonna see continue. Every time he's accused of something, he's going to accuse his accusers of that. So I think what's essential is to follow the corruption. We need to hammer the fact that the president, the president's tax returns need to be released. The president in the past was, as the New York Times investigation showed, did not pay taxes on hundreds of millions of dollars. The president is not on the side of his supporters. Unfortunately, what we're seeing is the kind of bond between leader and supporter that we associate not with a democratic country, but with an authoritarian country. And people will sacrifice their own self-interest under those conditions. And we also need to look to Republicans, because history shows us that it's the Republicans and conservatives who can stop fascism. We have to convince them that their duty and their loyalty should be to a multi-party state rather than a one-party state. And too many Republicans are thinking it's our time to create a one-party state. And they know that the only way to do that right now is through the leader.
That seems like a big challenge to convince them, but I do think that we need to engage, and I do agree with you there. Jason Stanley, a Yale University professor and author of How Fascism Works, The Politics of Us and Them. Thank you as always for joining us on the show today.
Thank you very much, Sean.
We're gonna take a short break here. On the other side, Ryan Grimm is gonna join us. We're gonna break down some of the news of the day, including attacks against Bernie Sanders following his health concerns from yesterday. Ever since it was announced early yesterday that Bernie Sanders had to have a stent put in after having a chest pain and uncomfortable feeling, I've just been waiting. You know, Cenk would say tick, 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 tick on people declaring that his presidency, his chances of getting into the White House are now over. And we already have a couple of cases of that. And joining me to break this and other stories down, DC bureau chief for The Intercept and contributor to The Young Turks, Ryan Grimm. Welcome back to the show.
It's great to be back here.
Great to have you here. Wish it could be for other topics, but this is what we've got.
Yes.
I want you to take a look at a short video from yesterday's edition of Tucker Carlson's show.
Now, Senator Bernie Sanders has suspended his campaign after he underwent emergency surgery for blocked arteries today. So this is a major development in the race. I want to say this with sincerity. We're, of course, hoping that Senator Sanders is okay. Of course, and that he's back in the race, because we are. But
absolutely,
if he doesn't get back in the race, you know, what does this mean? It's interesting that we haven't talked about this openly. I mean, all of us want to be polite, which I think is a good impulse. But 78, and he's not the only one who's, you know, of advanced age in this race. I mean, statistically speaking, it's tough to pull off a presidential campaign, much less running the most powerful country in the world at that age. I guess we're not allowed to say that. I'm 50 and I feel myself slowing down.
So are we going to have old sometimes?
Right. So are we going to have an honest conversation about this at some point, or are we going to continue to pretend that 78 is just like 38? Yeah, I think it's, again, not being mean.
Right. No, of course.
It's over.
Okay, so that accelerated fast from, you know, best wishes to Bernie Sanders to it's over, it's done. Are you surprised that of all the people to sort of declare his candidacy done, that Tucker Carlson got out in front of it? He was one of the earliest to say this thing is over.
No, because that's Tucker Carlson's thing. You know, his thing is to reject isms of all forms. And so here, what he thinks he's doing is he's taking on a reverse ageism, maybe, like an unwillingness among people to call out people for being past their prime because they don't want to be accused of ageism. And so he thinks that he can be un-PC and kind of break that and come in with this declaration that it's over. And I would actually take Tucker Carlson at his word when he says he does want Bernie Sanders in. He probably wants Bernie Sanders to win the nomination. It would be incredible ratings for Fox. You know, they've been pounding away at Democrats as socialists for, you know, before Fox was even a thing. Now they'd have a guy who actually says, yes, I'm a democratic socialist. This is how I want to remake the country and the economy. So Tucker Carlson would enjoy covering a spectacle like that. I would say there is a way that this could bounce to the benefit of the Sanders campaign. But if you do look at the politics of moments like this over the years, it doesn't bode terribly well. You have the Bob Dole in 1996, where he fell off the stage. It was on camera, and he'd already been facing questions about whether he was too old, and that was viewed as something that metaphorically was a nail in his coffin. In 2000, as Bill Bradley was kind of catching up to Al Gore, kind of running to his left, he had heart problems that drove a week of campaigning and sapped all of his momentum. Bill Bradley, one of the best NBA players in the sport's history, who's still alive today. You know, this is 18 years ago. But the media just fixated on it for a week, and the intensity of the coverage just saps a lot of energy. And then, of course, in 2016, Republicans spent millions of dollars saying that Hillary Clinton was secretly on death's door and was covering it up. And then she collapses at this 9/11 event, which again was on camera, and that changes things in our media culture. And that was played in a loop for days. And I think, you know, it probably did her some significant damage. So, you know, just the media reactions to this, separate from the reality of it, are going to impact the reality. Now, I'm curious for your take on this, but one way this could benefit him is, you know, his campaign has been, again, an unpleasant metaphor, has been flatlined, you know, over the last several months. You know, Americans love a comeback kid.
That's
they
true.
Love an underdog. So this could kind of paradoxically give him an opportunity to turn the campaign around. You know, if he somehow seizes the moment and starts to surge back and can make it sort of like a two-person race with Elizabeth Warren. If Biden continues to fade, he surges, he's the comeback kid, and now it's are we going to have Warren or Biden? I mean, Warren or Bernie as the nominee. Now he'd really have to thread the needle to do that, but at least kind of it does shake up the race and give him a chance.
I think that could very well be the case. I know people were worried that this was happening so close to the debate that he might miss it, but apparently that's not the case. He plans to be there. And look, if he hits that stage and he comes out stronger, more passionate than ever, that could change the narrative. I mean, what he doesn't have going for him is a mainstream media that is really excited about having a narrative that is very positive towards Bernie Sanders. That's one concern that they do have.
But they do, right, they're shallow though, and they do love those comeback narratives. And it wasn't looking like Sanders was going to do anything strategically to kind of shift up his campaign, which concern trolls on the right and the center were saying needed to be done, but also his allies on the left were saying like, look, you're not moving here. Warren is moving up, Biden is fading, something's gotta give. Or you're going to find yourself too far behind when Iowa rolls around, and you might, the amazing amount of organizing that the Sanders campaign is doing, and they're in the midst of a 10-day push where they're trying to have volunteers make 1 million calls, which is an extraordinary achievement, and I suspect that they're going to be able to make it. That helps, that expands the electorate, but you also have to be within striking distance, for that organizing to matter. Maybe this is morbidly the thing that he needed to shake the campaign up.
Yeah, perhaps. And I think one thing he has going for him is that I think a lot of people, they sort of look at, you have a bunch of people running for president, they're all out there campaigning, but not necessarily. Like some of them are doing way more events, traveling way more than others, and he's been right up at the top. So if he can maintain that, I think it's gonna be a little bit harder to get he's gonna drop dead in a month narrative to stick. We do have to go to a quick break, but would you be able to stick around for one more block to talk about? Okay, so we got a little bit more with Ryan Grimm on the other side of this break. So for some time now, we've had the transcript of Trump's call with the president of Ukraine. It is, of course, not actually a transcript, but still damning, even though it's not a word for word counting of what was actually said. But what if we had the actual transcript? What could be there? We're joined once again by Ryan Grimm to break this down. Ryan, welcome back. So here's the thing, Angus King.
Good to still be here.
Good to still have you here. Angus King says that him and his aides, they recreated from the transcript that we have, the call, and say that based on the length that the conversation was supposed to be, it's missing about 20 minutes. And then of course, even in the summary that we have, there's multiple cases, including right around the talk of favors and investigations, of ellipses clearly removing things from the conversation. If we do end up getting the actual transcript, do you have any sort of predictions or expectations of what it might contain?
Right. I mean, something feels off here, kind of in both directions. The claim that 20 minutes is missing to me just doesn't feel right. Like it feels like there are pieces missing, but not multiples of this entire conversation. Like for 20 minutes to be gone, that would mean that this was about a third of the overall conversation. And so maybe they're wrong about that number, like of how long it was, or there was a separate conversation among other officials. It's very hard to imagine where this other 20 minutes comes from. Yet from the other end, if you look at where those ellipses are, they come at moments where it seems like there ought to be more words there.
Yeah.
Like when he's talking about CrowdStrike. Now, on the other hand, if you've ever watched Trump at a rally, which I know you have, his stream of consciousness is just vegetable soup. and so he does end sentences in the middle, jump to a new thought, end that thought halfway through, and then jump to a new thought. That's more common than him actually completing a sentence with a subject and an object. And so because he's such a sunsetting kind of doddering old man, it's hard to know exactly what might be missing from there. And the other point is that we don't necessarily want to fall into a Republican trap and say there must be more, and then the full audio comes out, and then actually there isn't anything more, and this is all there is, because what there is damning,
yeah,
and impeachable. And so in some ways, like the constant grasping for more could end up coming back to backfire, rather than saying, look, what we have here, is enough to convict. On the other hand, you know, they're so corrupt that, Lord, certainly they could have cut some of this stuff out.
Yeah, I don't know that I disagree with anything that you said. I mean, my inclination is to say, I can look back at multiple instances over the past couple of years where transcripts have been manipulated by the White House. Like, we have the video on the one hand and then the transcript on the other. But if you were going to edit out the bad stuff, would you have left in, but I want you to do us a favor though? So do you see the inclusion of that sort of thing as strong evidence that no, this is probably about as bad as it gets?
It might be a little worse. And who knows what ramblingness he talks about in CrowdStrike. And as Trump pointed out, Zelensky is the first in this quote unquote transcript to bring up Giuliani. So either Giuliani was so front of his mind because Giuliani had been pestering him and his associates so much for information on Hunter Biden that he immediately talked about Giuliani, or in those ellipses he talks about Giuliani, and then that's why Zelensky then brings up Giuliani. Either explanation there is extremely damaging, because Giuliani here is the president's bagman, running around doing dirty work for the 2020 campaign by pressuring the Ukrainian president to dig up dirt on his at the time leading Democratic opponent. But like I said, you just can't. It is interesting to be in a place where the White House would release this information, and we can't trust what we're seeing with our own eyes. And that is a real that's a new kind of place that we've been. And of course, it has echoes of Trump's favorite president, Richard Nixon, and the 16-minute or 18-minute famous gap that appeared on the Nixon tapes that appeared to be the result of them wiping out extremely incriminating information. And yet what they did ultimately turn over, forced to by the Supreme Court, was extremely damaging to Nixon and drove his impeachment. So you can have both at the same time, turning over evidence that implicates you and also destroying evidence, additional evidence at the same time.
Yeah. We only have about a minute, but I am curious about your opinion. We have this transcript, looks really bad, obviously. I know that there is some interest in trying to get other transcripts of calls with Vladimir Putin, that sort of thing. Do you think that would be a wise move on the part of the Democrats, or does that potentially set them up for the sort of trap that you were talking about earlier?
I think particularly they should look for the calls with the Saudi royal family. Mm-hmm. I think going down the Putin rabbit hole again is a mistake, just because it conjures up too much Mueller report PTSD among the American public. But I don't think that Democrats have sufficiently explored the corrupt relationship between this White House and the Saudi royal family. And I think that's probably because Democrats have their own corrupt relationship with the Saudi royal family, which is only more reason why Democrats ought to clean up their own act, because they can take such cleaner shots at the corruption on the other side.
Exactly. If this could be the opportunity to finally break that relationship on both sides of the aisle, I think that would be a positive to come out of this. Ryan Grimm, DC Bureau Chief for The Intercept. Thank you as always. Great to have you on.
You got it.
Thank you. It's time once again to check in on news from around the world and outside of the world. And meanwhile, in. way out in deep space, turns out we might have a black hole close to our solar system. I'm gonna give you my non-scientific, super brief version of what is believed to have happened. So you have all of these trans-Neptunian objects way far out, super far out. And scientists have been analyzing them and trying to figure out why they move the way that they do. And it turned out that something needs to be there to influence their paths. Now, one idea is that there is this massive additional planet, 5 to 15 times the size of Earth, that's manipulating them. But some scientists say that that's not actually what it is. It's not a big planet, it's a very small black hole. And if true, the proposed black hole likewise would be located hundreds of times farther from the sun than Earth. But because black holes are incredibly adept at crushing down matter, a black hole equivalent to roughly 5 Earth masses would be only about the size of a baseball. So depending, we've either got a baseball or softball sized literal black hole, like far, but not that far. Not as far as you would want for something that generally when we see it in movies is the most horrendous thing literally imaginable to humans. We've got a little message I want to give you from an astronomer who says this. The important thing to understand here is that all that the calculations can tell us about these objects way far out is the mass of planet 9, not its composition. So in principle, it could be a planet, a potato, a black hole, a hamburger. This person was very hungry while giving this quote, as long as its orbital parameters are right. So I have a lot of thoughts about this black hole. I don't actually, it's just really cool. Isn't that weird? I mean, who would have thought? I don't know what to take from this. I do know one thing you shouldn't take from this, and it was summarized in, I believe it was a Daily Mail headline that says, watch out, black hole could devour entire solar system and turn Earth to dust. Okay, that's maybe potentially possible. I don't think that's gonna happen anytime soon. If the black hole's out there, it's probably been there for a few days. I think we're probably okay. Meanwhile, in. Meanwhile, in Japan, a number of different studies have shown that workplace harassment, abuse, and even assault is a significant problem. And it's a reminder that though we've done a little bit of work here in the US, especially when it comes to harassment of women on the job, it is still a massive problem, both here and abroad. I want to give you some numbers. 36.3% of women with mental illnesses said that they had suffered from sexual harassment, assault, bullying, and abuse of power at work by superiors, according to a survey in a White Power on measures to prevent death from overwork. So obviously, this is a very serious study. The consequences of not getting this thing right is a number of suicides, fairly common in Japan. And that number, I mean, whatever you thought that number would be, the fact that more than 1 out of 3 women have said that anything from harassment and abuse to all like assault, even rape, that is incredibly scary stuff. It's true for men as well, though at lower numbers. The survey found about 23.1% of male workers with mental health issues cited a change in their job role or workload as the main cause for their problems. 15.9% attributed the problem to assault, bullying, and abuse of power. So on both sides, there is a bullying and abuse of power to go around, but it is affecting women at more than twice the rate, which is a serious problem that needs to be addressed. Another study, this is a separate study. They were looking into freelancers in Japan and how they're treated. Now, these are people who have less power in the workplace. They're considered expendable to some extent. It found that 61.6% of freelancers have experienced work-related power harassment. So that isn't necessarily specifically sexual, but it's not necessarily not sexual. And it turns out there was quite a bit of that as well. 36.6% said they'd faced sexual harassment. 214 in a study involving just about 1,200 people said they'd been forcibly asked to have sexual relationships. 66% were stalked. 53 people said they were raped. That is 53 out of just 1,200. Okay, that's not 60%, but that is an unacceptably high number. So this sort of abuse of power, sexual and non-sexual, just use of power, abuse, assault, stalking, rape, serious problem. Now, obviously, this is something for Japan to deal with. A reminder here that we may not have these high of numbers, but we do have a serious problem as well. And I worry that over the past few years, people's sort of eye has gone off the prize. Meanwhile, in. Meanwhile, in Saudi Arabia, I am reminded that it is just one day after the 1 year anniversary of the brutal murder of Jamal Khashoggi, a murder for which there was no consequences whatsoever, but perhaps there could be. So I want you to take a look at an interview 60 Minutes had with Mohammed bin Salman, the man responsible for this murder. Take a look at what he says about it.
Did you order the murder of Jamal Khashoggi?
Absolutely not. This was a heinous crime. But I take full responsibility as a leader in Saudi Arabia, especially since it was committed by individuals working for the Saudi government.
What does that mean, that you take responsibility?
When a crime is committed against a Saudi citizen by officials working for the Saudi government, as a leader, I must take responsibility. This was a mistake, and I must take all actions to avoid such a thing in the future.
A mistake. That's one way to put it, a mistake. So he started off his response when she said, you know, did you order? He says, not reassuring. Not reassuring if I'm predisposed to believe that you ordered that this person be brutally murdered, cut into bits, carted off, and the body disposed of somewhere. But he gets past that and he gets around to saying that while he didn't order it, he is responsible. And so that might lead you to wonder, well, okay, if you're responsible, if you take responsibility, if you're worried about the fact that this could set a precedent where people working for other rulers might do the same thing, what form should your responsibility take? Well, conveniently this week, news broke of a form that it could come in. This is two Washington attorneys calling on the International Criminal Court Chief Prosecutor Fatou Bensouda to push for an investigation into Saudi Arabia's Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, who you just saw, for the alleged kidnapping, torture, and assassination of Jamal Khashoggi 1 year after his disappearance. So that looks like it would be consequences. That looks like if you were to go along with that, that would be actually taking responsibility for it. Because taking responsibility to the host of 60 Minutes, that's one thing. Taking legal responsibility and potentially facing some sort of consequences, that is a far better form of responsibility. I want to give you a little more information about this petition. It refers to the murder of Khashoggi, who worked for the Washington Post prior to his death on October 2nd last year. The torture of dissidents, persecution of human rights activists, multiple war crimes in Yemen, and other offenses as instances of the Crown Prince's crimes against humanity. So of course, considering the anniversary, I am tying it in with that particularly heinous murder. But this is a guy, this is a regime who's committed human rights abuses all over the place. Horrid murder of civilians, the deliberate targeting of civilians, allowing for starvation, chronic diseases to spread throughout the population of Yemen and other places. A little bit more information, the petition contends that the Crown Prince's assassination of Mr. Khashoggi threatens international peace and stability, and if left unpunished, the assassination will embolden Mohammed bin Salman to greater recklessness. And that is my concern, the idea that if there are not consequences, that he could be perhaps incentivized to do something else. That really just mirrors what he said. It was a great mistake, and the worry is that it will lead to other employees doing this sort of thing. So I have that worry, Mohammed bin Salman has that worry. Here is a potential way to square that circle. Go along with this investigation, go to the ICC, see to what extent you deserve actual consequences for the responsibility that you say is yours alone. That is my message to Mohammed bin Salman. We only have about a minute. I did want to read, I've been trying to do more of this. For those of you who've been listening to the podcast on iTunes, it's available on other things too, Pocket Cast and Stitcher and all that. Always appreciate your reviews. One came in from the ex-Dark Knight saying, I love this show. I'm a TYT longtime subscriber and I really enjoy John's sense of humor and his nerdy metaphors. Thank you. I read a more critical review a couple of days ago, and I apologize for giving the impression of that individual that I took it harshly when I was compared to Ben Shapiro. It was all in good fun. I was just joking around. I appreciate all the reviews, including the more critical ones. So feel free to leave those as well. Okay, that's all the time we have right now, but there is gonna be overtime. If you're watching this on our live linear platforms, you can become a TYT member to get the ability to watch the full show, you know, including overtimes. So feel free to go to tyt.com/join to do that. If not, it will be available on YouTube a little bit later on, so you can look forward to there. We're gonna be doing Meanwhile In, so you're definitely gonna wanna see that. Thank you for everybody who's been watching this show. One more day, Brett Ehrlich's gonna be joining us tomorrow. Should be a lot of fun as always, so we'll see you tomorrow morning. Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.